Blog Talk Radio.
A licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with a Chicken Whisperer radio show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Monday, June 10th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
And you can find all the great Ware products here.
Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com.
It's easy and rewarding to keep backyard chickens, and My Pet Chicken can supply everything you need to get started, including baby chicks, chicken coops, accessories, books, and free how-to information, plus fun gifts and rooster decor. At My Pet Chicken, you can buy as few as 3 baby chicks. They also sell fertile hatching eggs. Visit them online at mypetchicken.com. That's mypetchicken.com.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. It's so good to be back. Thank you very much for joining us today. We do have a hot topic today and a great guest coming up today. We've got Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor and founder of FirstStateVetSupply.com. And he's going to be here talking about mites and lice, specifically the northern fowl mite and lice as well. And we initially were going to talk about this topic, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, and then all of a sudden I saw in the caller queue in the switchboard that Dr. McCray was on. And so she was not available to come the next week, which was her assigned week, so we just had Dr. McCray on, and she covered a lot of awesome studies that were very interesting, and we said, well, we'll postpone Peter Brown to today, so no worries there. And so again, we've got a great show lined up for you today with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of FirstStateVetSupply.com, and he's going to be teaching us all about mites and lice. It's going to be an awesome, awesome show. So we hope you got that Chicken Whisperer notebook out with all your notes in it from all the great expert guests we have on for the last over 5 years and over 815 episodes right here on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. So thank you very much for joining us. Hope you've had a great weekend. A great weekend. I'm still on the road. That's my life story. And nonetheless, the show must go on. We are still up in the Atlanta area. We came up here for Jen's work, if you remember last week. She had some end-of-the-year training with her job now that she's off maternity leave. And she had a couple of days Wednesday and Thursday. And then we had a birthday party to attend yesterday, so we decided a family birthday party, one-year-old. And so we decided to stay up for that. We'll be heading back tomorrow morning. We will be back at the homestead for a couple of weeks, which is great because I'm sure, even though we got a bunch of work done before we went on this trip in the garden and around the homestead to try to get it tidied up before our time gone, we will, I'm sure, have a lot to do with the garden. I'm sure it's growing like crazy, all of the great crops we have planted. So I'm sure we'll be getting caught up with all of that. So, Jen slammed the camper door, and of course now Lily woke up Lily. But normally she's pretty good about heading back to sleep. So I'm sorry, baby girl. This is a family affair. If you haven't seen us on the road, we do travel as a family in the Chicken Whisperer Mobile, which happens to be the RV. And so yeah, she's tied back down. It just scared her when she closed the camper door. Jen's taken Caleb over to the fun barn to have a good time for a couple of hours while we do the show. But the camper door scared her a little bit. She jumped and was like, meh. Probably heard her in the background. So, getting ready to get back to the homestead. We'll be there just for a couple of weeks, and then we're going to be hitting the road again. How awesome is that? But this time, we'll be on the Tractor Supply Chicken Whisperer Tour, second quarter tour. We had a great time back in February when we went on the first quarter tour. Had great turnout. Had a great time in southern Alabama and northern Florida. And then now, this time, we're heading to the Carolinas, North Carolina and South Carolina. Let me see if I can remember real quick about, in case you live in that area, where you can come out, have a good time, see us, and come to one of the events. Let me see if I've got it. I probably have it already by memory, but I just want to make sure I look and give you the right information. So here we go. We've got Wednesday, June 26th. Wednesday, June 26th, we'll be in Anderson, South Carolina, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at that local Tractor Supply. Looking forward to seeing you there in Anderson. And then Thursday, 5 events in 5 days. So these are consecutive. Wednesday, June 26th, Anderson, South Carolina, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Thursday, June 27th, Easley, South Carolina, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Friday, June 28th, Weaverville, North Carolina, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Saturday, June 29th, Asheville, North Carolina. Really looking forward to Asheville. Beautiful, beautiful area. Saturday, June 29th, again, Asheville, North Carolina. That's a Saturday, so it'll be 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. We'll broadcast the radio show live from that location from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m., and then from 10 to 12, we'll have the big event. And then Sunday, June 30th, we'll be in Newton, North Carolina. And that's Sunday afternoon, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. So you have time to get to church, go out to lunch with the family, go home and fix lunch, and then come on out to their local Tractor Supply. Again, all of these events in Anderson, Easley, Weaverville, Asheville, and Newton will be in their local Tractor Supply stores in those towns. Each event basically includes a two-hour, about an hour and a half, getting started with backyard poultry workshop that talks a little bit about everything from incubation to brooding to getting started, choosing the right breed for you, nutrition, coops, predators, the whole nine yards. So if you're out there, you'll love it. Come on out and see me. Plus, every event includes a book signing. We will have books available at these events, so we can do a little autograph session and book signing, and, of course, other pictures and autographs, Q&A, things like that. I'm normally available an hour, officially an hour before the official event starts. So if the event is from 6 to 8, you can come on out at 5. I'll be there ready and ready to answer your questions and meet you and do pictures and autographs and stuff at an hour before the official event starts. So the weekday event, 6 to 8 p.m., I'll be available at 5. The Saturday event, 9 to 10, we'll be doing the radio show. So I should be available starting about 8 a.m. there in Asheville. And then Sunday, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., I'll be available starting at 1 p.m. to answer all your questions, shake your hand, give you a big bear hug, and talk chicken. So gotta love spreading the chicken love all across this great land. We absolutely enjoy doing that. And it's so much fun to be able to meet the fans, meet the chicken lovers out there. And also, if you're planning on going to the Chicken Scratch second annual chicken stock, which is up there, I believe it's in Statesville, North Carolina, just about 30 minutes outside of Newton, I believe. It's also going to be that weekend, Saturday the 29th, Sunday the 30th, and that again is the Chicken Scratch. You can find them on Facebook, second annual chicken stock. We've already heard from several families that are going to be out there. They're going to be camping, tent camping there, and they got about 5 acres. A lot of it's pasture, and we're going to try to make that event. I haven't really sat down and figured out how. We may actually leave Asheville on Saturday as soon as we can, and we may drive all the way to Statesville and set up camp there, and then just make the 30-minute track back to Newton for the Sunday afternoon event, and then once that event's done, go back over there. So I'm still trying to work out the logistics. We'll just have to see how that all pan out and see if we can't borrow a water hose and an extension cord from them for the big RV while we are there. So, but I'm really looking forward to get on the road. When am I not on the road? But it is so much fun, especially when we're doing something chicken-related, spreading the chicken love nationwide. Nobody else is doing it. We've been doing it for years. Gotta love the chickens. And we'd like to hear from you. If you are battling City Hall right now, trying to get chickens approved in your area, and I know it's an uphill battle in most cases, send me an email. Let me know about it. We may be coming to your town, or maybe we can arrange to come to your town. Just send it over to chickenwhisperer@chickenwhisperer.net. That's chickenwhisperer@chickenwhisperer.net. And we'll maybe just try to get your town. There's several times me and Jen have talked about maybe just hitting the road for a couple of weeks or so and then kind of spreading the chicken love that way, kind of on our own, maybe not specified by Tractor Supply or the feed companies or any of our sponsors, but just on our own and stopping en route along the way at towns that are trying to get the law changed and maybe talking with the council members there, seeing the folks out there, our fans, their coops and their chickens and things like that. So if you're in that predicament where you're trying to get chickens legalized in your area, we'd like to hear about it. Again, chickenwhisperer@chickenwhisperer.net. Send me over an email, and we'll try to get that done. So probably in just a few more minutes, we'll have Peter Brown, the chicken doctor, calling in, and we'll get started with today's topic, which is going to be mites and lice, and specifically the northern fowl mite, and then lice as well. And we may have a little time to take some of your phone calls and maybe take some questions from the chat room as well, as it's starting to fill up over there. We know that there's a lot of people, hundreds of you that listen live every day. And we thank you for that. You just can't get in the chat room because it's either blocked by your IT department at work, maybe, and I know who you guys are. Thank you very much for letting me know that's the deal. And then maybe Blog Talk Radio is being kind of a pain in the rear end today, and it's just not opening up. You're sitting there listening to me right now, maybe via telephone, or maybe you're listening online, but the chat room is just sitting there spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning, and you can't get in the chat room. We understand. We feel your pain. I hear from you guys as well, and maybe you can contact Blog Talk Radio and let them know that you're having issues. Maybe it's the specific browser you're on. More people have luck on Firefox than they do Internet Explorer. Google Chrome seems to be working okay from people I've heard, but Internet Explorer is probably the worst to listen to this live podcast. Now, the saved ones, the archived ones, may do fine on Internet Explorer, but the live one seldom. We hear from people regarding the Internet Explorer. Real big shout out right now to all the folks that are listening live. Thank you very much for doing so. Everybody that listens to the archive, and there's thousands of you, thank you so much for making this a popular show for the last 5 years. Thank you very much. And then I want to send out a shout-out to all the homeschoolers out there that listen to the show, incorporate the show into their curriculum every day. Thank you very much, homeschoolers. Hope you're enjoying your summer. But I know a lot of you work through the summer. Sorry, kids. But, hey, it's all about getting smart and learning and heading off to college if you choose to. So also the over-the-road truck drivers we see when we're on the road, we make a habit to stop at all the truck stops when we have to and fill up and hang out. And we hear from you guys to keep the rubber on the road. We thank you for listening to the archive whenever you can. We appreciate that. And, of course, all the feed and seed stores all across this great land that stream this radio show live every single day to your customers. We thank you. We hope business is well. And maybe we'll see you on a Chicken Whisperer tour or next time we're stopping through town. No worries there. I do have a Chickens in the News segment here that I'd like to share with you guys. I'm going to have to bring it up here for a minute. It was very interesting, and I'll be honest, I haven't read all of it yet. I was going to wait and post it, actually, on my Facebook page right after the radio show. I wanted a lot of people to actually see it. So let me go ahead and give me a second, and I'll kind of give you the logistics of it, and then I will actually post it. I'll actually post it on my Facebook page just a little bit later, but it's very interesting, and it reminded me about how a lot of times I warn people about these chicken tours, chicken coop tours that I've been a part of in the past. I've been to several of them across the country. No worries there, and I always tell folks, and I'll get a board, put this in so I can pull this up. Maybe it'll work the first time. That'll be very helpful if it does. And then I can kind of give you the logistics of what this interesting article is all about. Let me find it here. Oh, no. Oh, here it is. There it is. Perfect. I was like, oh, no, did it get deleted somehow? Okay, let me pull. Okay, here we go. And I have not read this, so I'll read a little bit of it and give you an idea of what it's about, and then I'll post it, especially if it's very lengthy. But anyway, I talk about and I tell folks, those who are organizing the chicken coop tours and things like that, about the risks of biosecurity. Of course, being the national spokesperson for the USD Biosecurity for Birds program, I feel kind of obligated to do that. So let me just give you an idea, mainly because think about it. If the very first coop, the very first flock, okay, has some type of illness or disease. And these folks, I mean, to tell you, if you've ever been on a chicken coop tour, they're letting you walk in the run, they're letting you walk in the coop, you're stepping in poop, you're stepping in all that, and then guess what? You get in your car, and you drive, or you ride your bike, or you walk down the street to the next coop, and then you walk in their coop, you walk in their run, and whatever disease you just picked up from that flock, the flock before that, and the flock before that, you're spreading to every single coop on that tour. Bottom line. Now, do I have any proof that anything has happened up to this point? No. Maybe there has. Maybe somebody all of a sudden lost their entire flock to this disease because of disease spread on a coop tour. They just didn't pinpoint it. It was months later. They didn't figure it out. Surely it wasn't that. But it's one of those things. Maybe, possibly, has the possibility of happening one of these days. Entire flocks will be wiped out because of a chicken coop tour because they're not using biosecurity protection. So I saw this, and I wanted to post it. This is a little bit different twist on it, and this comes to highly contagious diseases shut down chicken swaps. Okay, this comes to us from Jennifer Keefe. This comes to us from Dover. I'm guessing Dover. Is that Delaware? With any animal, people, With any animal people raise in their homes, there are always diseases and other health issues that one hopes to be prevented. And the same goes for backyard chickens. Recently, chicken swaps in the state were voluntarily suspended due to the spread of two avian diseases, microplasma and or MG, and respiratory illness and microplasma or MS, which affects joints. While these highly contagious diseases aren't harmful to humans or any other non-bird species, they are deadly to birds. The diseases have been detected among the chicken population in the state due in part to the swapping of baby and adult chickens among breeders and other interested in chicken keeping. Chicken Swaps of New Hampshire, which holds swaps in areas around the state, announced the suspension in late May because of the positive testing for these diseases after owners complained of sick birds. We had a flock of sick birds when we were doing our regular testing. We ran additional tests and found they were positive for MS and MG, said Cindy Crawford. Program assistant at the Division of Animal Industry and State Department of Agriculture. So I'm going to post this on our Facebook page here very shortly, and so this news can get out there. But how many times have I told you? I got an email about 2 weeks ago from a lady that actually stopped by a flea market, and she saw this rooster. It had one eye, and it wasn't really looking too healthy, and it tugged at her heartstrings, apparently, and she wanted to actually take this rooster home. She didn't at that time. She got home. She emailed me. She told me about the rooster. She told me how she felt so sorry for it, wanted to give it a good home, blah, blah, blah. So I got it. Okay, I said, look, if it were me, I probably would not do that, but I completely understand, ma'am, how that is tugging at your heartstrings. You're a compassionate person. You love your chickens. You might want to try to do better for this bird and give it a great life. I get it 100%. I said, I cannot tell you what to do because your heart is pulling at your emotions. I said, I can tell you this. If you choose, okay, if your heart wins, I basically said, if your heart wins and you drive back to that flea market tomorrow and get that bird, please, 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 keep it quarantined for at least 30 days, okay? We talked about possibly doing a worming rotation on it. We talked about doing diatomaceous earth. We talked about maybe a round of antibiotics. We talked about all this kind of stuff. But mainly keep it quarantined from your current healthy flock for at least 30 days and look for snifflies and sneezies and mites and lice and any snotty noses and drainage out of the beak and eye issues and all this stuff. 30 days, okay, maybe even give it a round. Have it tested for, do a fecal flotation test, $25. See if it's got any type of worms from your local vet. Look for mites and lice on a regular basis. Do everything you can to make sure this bird is completely and 100% healthy as best you can do before you integrate it into your current flock. So I get those emails on occasion, but I'm going to post this one a little bit later here on our Facebook page because I think it's very important. Highly contagious diseases, shut down chicken swaps, and we know there's a lot out there. And in fact, there'll be a chicken stock coming up here that we may be attending. So it's just one of those interesting things. And let's get over here. I think maybe in the phone lines. Let me get over here. Yep, we got Peter Brown calling in. He's been listening to all this. So we can get his take here quickly on it. And so we'll go to the switchboard. And we've got Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of First State Vet Supply, joining us. Let's give him a big Chicken Whisperer welcome. Hey, Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Andy, what's going on?
Not a lot. I guess you kind of heard a little bit of this news thing I'm about to post. It came out yesterday on the news wire. Highly contagious diseases shut down chicken swaps. This comes to us from Dover, and talking about how some places have voluntarily banned chicken swaps right now because of MG and I believe they said it was MS, and so because they found it and they found people having flocks that were dying because of it, and oh, where'd you get your birds? I got it at a chicken swap and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, like I said, even with like we talked about the coop, the coop tours and things, there's always that risk. I tell people, please, you don't have to let people to know what keeping chickens all about. Let them in the run and in the coop. You can have, okay, set up a barrier here. You can observe everything that you need to see from here without having to walk in my coop and in my run and track poop back into your car and then track all this possible disease to the next coop, to the next coop, to the next coop. But this came out yesterday, Sunday, June 9th, about states that are banning chicken swaps right now due to the issue of spreading disease. What say you, my friend?
Well, it's 6 1/2 dozen the other. I just love it when you know, the governmental agencies who you know, make these decisions based on in some cases some evidence. You said Dover where?
Yeah, that's all I got. Dover.
Okay.
Is that Delaware?
Well, it could be. That's why I'm asking.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying.
I will say this. Let's assume for the moment it is Dover, Delaware, and this is an attempt by the state veterinarian who is there. And I hate to use these terms because I don't deal with these people directly, but you know, for the most part, most of them are not poultry veterinarians. They're puppets. That's what they are. They're puppets for the commercial poultry industry. And don't get me wrong. You know, we need to protect the commercial poultry industry as well as we do any other crop industry that we have, whether it be turkeys or wheat or whatever. But all of these things are short-sighted. If they would just make the commercial poultry industry clean up their own mess, you know, here they're allowed to go down the road, and you know, because there are children listening, poop and feathers flying everywhere. Okay, on every tractor for every farmer who is cleaning out a chicken house. Up and down the road, some chicken catching crews have been banned from some of the little roadside stores, little you know, gas and goes and whatever you want to call them, because they come in, they stink to high heaven, they run off every customer that's in the place because they can't stand it, and then they've got manure all over their boots and they wipe them on the rug, and then they go out with their sandwiches. While they've spent some money, it may not air itself out for 2 days, and somebody's got to clean that rug, and you know, all these kinds of issues. So I said this before, you know, there isn't a farm here that I probably at some point in time during the day couldn't just walk on the farm and pretty much walk into the chicken house. They're not locked. You know, you might remember the incident here in Del Mar, Delaware, which is about 10 miles or so from where I'm talking to you. Some guy, young guy, he was drunk and had some issues.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And he went and he pulled the switch that was unguarded and everything else. So if they have all this biosecurity, how did this happen? It happened because nobody cares, because it's all about money, and it gets passed from the grow-out people who are just pawns for the commercial poultry industry, because they have no say over how the flock is really grown. They get their marching orders from the grow-out company. You have a chicken house, but they're birds, and everything else that goes into them. The feed is all there. There's you know, you have no say in what they get fed, how much they get fed. They just tell you what to do. And so, you know, there's a minimal amount of biosecurity that goes on, and that is only when a service person goes from farm to farm. He does wash his boots and a disinfectant and put on a pair of coveralls before he goes into the next person's chicken house. But that's the extent of it. You know, when the feed truck driver comes on the farm, he's been on whatever farm. If he's not dropping off a whole load of feed to you, which on occasion they don't, because let's say your flock's going out in 2 days, but you're going to be 2 days short of feed. He's not going to bring a whole truckload of feed, then have to come back and pull it all out because they'll be putting starter feed in for the next flock. So they come in, they put 2 days, 3 days worth of feed in there, and you know, he goes from your farm to the next farm with the balance of the load. They don't come out with just 2, 3, 4, 5 ton of feed. They, you know, so
right.
It is what you make it, and people have to understand what it is. It's the same thing as going down to the lab with your birds, and he says, you've got mycoplasma, you're better off to put all your birds down. Well, you know, he has a valid point on one hand, but on the other hand, he's got no dog in the fight. He doesn't have the emotional connection, he doesn't have the monetary connection, and he doesn't have, in many cases, the 30, 40, 50 years of breeding that went into these birds, you know, in order to get to the point of where they are. So, you know, and then you take the other side of the fence, okay? I'll play devil's advocate here, both sides of the fence.
Okay.
And I'll give you an ongoing thing, because I was going to talk about this. I had no time to really give you a heads up on it, but it's no big deal. We talk about anything and everything on the show anyway. So
absolutely.
and this is directly chicken related, and I'm not going to name names or even the breed of the bird. This is a particular bird breed that evidently I've never heard of it before myself, and that's not uncommon. I don't follow all the breeds. You could give me a quiz on breeds and I'd fail tomorrow because and miserably at it because I don't remember all of them, nor do I care. But evidently this is a breed somebody's trying to get going, and you know, that's cool. It's a neat looking bird and what have you. But there seems to be within the breed a particular problem, and that problem is called osteopetrosis. Now, most people will probably never heard of it, but it's somewhat rare these days because the commercial poultry industry recognized it many, many years ago and said, we can't have this. What it is chicken bone cancer. Okay, it affects mainly starts out affecting the long bones of the birds, and the legs get very thick. You'd almost swear if you didn't know really what scaly leg mite looked like, and if we get to it today, we'll talk a little bit about that just as an add-on, but it almost looks like that, except as a general rule, the scales are not raised. The leg increases in diameter, okay, and takes on a real glassy-looking look in some cases. I've seen other cases where it didn't take on that same thing other than being much, much thicker than you would expect a chicken leg to be. And this is caused by a particular type of a, if you look into this, what we call lymphoid leucosis or the leucosis complex, which is made up of lymphoid leucosis, which we know is big liver disease, and that's where it's basically liver cancer in chickens. And there's another one. I can't remember the names of all of them. Really immaterial because it's something that they've bred away from. The lymphoid leucosis, big liver disease, you can breed away from it. You find you have offspring with it. You euthanize them. You find the parents from them and you euthanize them. And you clean up and go on. And every time it happens, you keep euthanizing until you get away from it. First thing you know, you won't have anybody with it. The lymphoid leucosis spreads a little bit more readily than does this osteopetrosis. The problem with the osteopetrosis, and this bothers me, people wanting to get birds tested and everything else, the bird can still test negative, but it's still possible to be there. And part of that is because there's two schools of thought on this. One, it's caused by a sarcoma-type virus. And the other is there's this thing of a spontaneous appearance of this problem. And there seems to be another school of thought that it is triggered by the lymphoid leucosis virus. So you could test birds that actually have the disease and still come up negative, but you would still have this bird that has these unsightly, very large diameter legs, and it has to eventually, and this is not fact, this is just me thinking out loud, but it has to eventually affect the immune system because this calcification or extra calcification of the bone takes up the bone marrow space in the leg. The bone becomes pretty much solid, and in some cases they call it marble bone. Another name for it was thick leg disease, and that's exactly how it presents itself. So what I'm trying to say here is that I was asked my opinion. I rendered my opinion actually to somebody I'm fairly good friends with, and to my knowledge, you know, the bird hasn't been put down. There were, in this particular group, there were about, I think, three or four birds that were survivors, one with the problem. And it can become what I would call systemic. In other words, you can see it in other bones besides. So it becomes what, I guess, to a degree, bilateral. You can see it in the wing bones, in the joints, in the leg joints, and things like that. Similar to what you might see, in a sense, within the joints, maybe like a hip dysplasia type thing along those lines. But it is somewhat rare in that we don't see it anymore in the commercial poultry industry per se because they've taken the time to eliminate it. And here we are with a new breed or a newer breed. I don't even know where it came from. Again, nor do I care. But we're monkeying around with this thing that can't be fixed. And, you know, there's evidently some vet at the University of Georgia who's interested in it, but he's only interested in it for teaching purposes. You know, and he's rendered some opinions on some other people that have had a similar problem in the past, and that's fine, you know. But these birds that are coming from a particular breeder or wherever they're coming from, I don't know who it is, and like I said, if I knew the names, wouldn't give them out. It's not important. What's important is that people recognize that there is a problem that can't be fixed. It needs to be dealt with and dealt with right away. And I know it's painful. You know my feelings about putting birds down and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And, you know, therein lies the problem. So you see that on both sides of the fence. I have another client not all that far from me, probably a two-and-a-half-hour drive from me, that is going through that now with mycoplasma. And not only have the Mycoplasma galliseptacum, they have the Mycoplasma synoviae as well. So you have a double whammy because the synoviae is not such a big deal until something else comes along and triggers it and the two together get ugly. And, you know, the attempt there is going to be to try to control it with some Adenoguard and with some vaccination and stuff. And again, the initial thought of this particular individual is to go and put them all down. Noble thought in the beginning, but after you start looking at birds that are not experiencing any difficulty, it's pretty hard to pick them up and, you know, wring their neck. So it's always, if I'm making sense to anybody, it's both sides of the fence. The information that I saw back during Cooptastic, Dr. Batista from the Delaware lab here put up a bunch of information. While they're not finding in the backyard setting or birds with avian influenza, they are finding a lot of the MGMS type things, some bronchitis, those kinds of things, you know, which are detrimental to the commercial poultry industry. So it doesn't surprise me that you know, that the state veterinarian would take such action based on that. That particular criteria doesn't surprise me at all. And again, I go back and I say, and I don't know this particular person who's the state veterinarian here in Delaware. They've changed it several times. The original guy that used to be at Dr. West Towers, he was a poultryman's dream. Both sides of the fence. He understood the commercial side, but he raised chickens of his own, and he understood that. To give you an example, he had a great rapport with people who fight chickens. Not that he condoned that, but he knew where they were because they were his friend. When he had a problem, he helped them fix it, okay? And so if there was an outbreak, he could at least, he had a list of people. He could get a secretary to start, okay, here's my list. Call these people and tell them we got a problem, X, X, X. I want to see some birds. I want to see some blood or some whatever. So he had that kind of rapport. He's retired now, and that rapport has gone by the boards. They've done nothing but screw it up. It's just a mess. You know, they'll never get that rapport back, even with Dr. Batista, as easy a going guy as he is, because he's more along West Towers thinking, but he's only director of the laboratory. He's not the state veterinarian. Okay. And
right.
you find most of these veterinarians, I think this one that's in there now is a, and don't ask me why they do this. I guess no poultry guy's got enough sense to take the job. I think that's my thinking, because I've never seen a poultry guy in that particular thing. They're all large animal vets. And if you look at, Delaware and Maryland, it's chickens for the most part. So I don't get that part of it, but I do get the other part. And I've helped many a person, you know, through, you know, if you really truly want to clean up the mycoplasma, the way to do it is go through and find out who is positive, who's negative, put down the positive ones and start over. Disinfection program, vaccination program works well. I've got a client here. He's in his second, third year now of raising birds mycoplasma-free, but, you know, went through the ovens of hell to get it done. But, you know, the vet up there, it's almost a year and a half ago now, there was an outbreak in a small backyard flock of LT that the person picked up at one of the shows. And, you know, she acted like that was the end of the world, and had not a clue as to, you know, the vaccine that's available to people. The party that had the problem called me. I was going to send the vaccine out. Then They told the state vet, said, no, you can't use that. He doesn't have access to this vaccine. It's special and everything else. And, I said to the person, look, do what they want to do. They're going to come down. They're going to vaccinate him. It's a freebie. They're going to come down with people that, they're going to do the labor. They're going to provide the vaccine. It doesn't cost you a dime. I said, I don't care if I sell it to you or don't. It's not that big a deal. So I said, go ahead and let them do it. I said, but when you get it, I said, get me the name and everything off the bottle. Same stuff I sell. No, nothing different. See, they don't know their backside from a hole in the wall lots of times. And this is what happens when you have somebody who is not in that loop and, thinks that it's something special. The only reason that the state vet personally came down to do it was to look at the poultry companies and say, look, we had an outbreak. I did something, that's kind of the way it works. So I don't know if it helped this conversation or not, but nothing surprises me these days. And I think you're going to see it just keep tightening up in more liberal areas, and I don't mean it politically, in areas where there's less poultry. I think you'll see less problems with these kinds of things. In your more populated poultry states, you're going to see a pushback against some of this stuff, and they'll use the disease angle. When, by and large, you still have to go back and ask yourself, no matter what, the only people that have ever had the avian influenza problem to any great degree has been the commercial poultry industry. The only ones that have ever really had the salmonella problem is them. So, it's the pot calling the kettle black, and it's just the way it goes sometimes. But and maybe another answer that you might have been looking for here is that would I have taken that bird home? No, I wouldn't have. I advise against it all the time. Unless you got deep pockets and you want to spend a lot of time, effort, and money, because none of that stuff is usually, at least when it gets to that point, none of it is cured easily. If ever cured, it's always an ongoing, nightmare. So, just from that standpoint, you never bring a bird home, into a flock of relatively healthy birds, birds that it is obviously sick. Even if you're going to quarantine, that stuff generally, I've not seen people been able to really quarantine things properly. They end up with sick birds all over the place. It just
They wait a week and a half. Oh, he looks healthy. Let's just go ahead and integrate him.
Yeah. Well, how many times have we said it on this show? And I continue to say it. I said it again to a person that called seeking some information this morning. This nonsense that they just have a cold or they don't feel well. Well, that just doesn't fly. And we've seen it time in, time out. And I don't know what more to say. I'll tell you one thing though. I made an attempt here in the last month and a half or so to be cordial and congenial to people on some of these boards, but I can't take it. I just seem to be beat with a stick. It just boggles my mind stupidity that's out there. And you reach out to people, and I'm afraid to give you my phone number over the internet. Give me a break. Guess what? You get no help. You think I'm going to sit here and type things for an hour? You're nuts. But I think that's probably what prompted me to put up on Facebook this morning. I very rarely make a comment when, at the top of the feed it says what's on your mind, and I just put a...
you got to be careful with that, don't you?
Did you see what I posted up there?
I have not.
You didn't see it? This is kind of cute. I said, good morning, nuts and bolts.
Happens to be on your mind. There it is.
Yeah, it's congenially meant. I got a lot of good folks out that I deal with that are friends and fans and people that I help somewhat on a regular basis. I'm delighted to do it in 99% of the cases. The other 1% make you not want to do it at all. But we will persevere on it. But this osteoporosis, petrosis thing, rather, it is part of what we call a leucosis complex, and it is something that, because it's showing its ugly head in this particular breed, needs to be dealt with, and dealt with very forcefully and very sharply. And I don't think a lot of people that are associated with this particular breed are wanting to do that. But if they don't, I think that this can be an ongoing problem in that particular breed. And the problem with it is then if it spreads bird to bird, which it does, it's not a good spreader, but it's still there. So birds that are exposed, you never know, and you don't usually see it until birds are at least 12, 14, 15, 16 weeks of age, right, when you've got all that money and hard work into them, say. And it is a problem. And it's painful for the bird, obviously, because it takes up that whole inner space where the bone marrow is in the legs and then works its way out to other body bones at the same time. So it's just one of those things that, and it may come along with the lymphoid leucosis. There is some indication that, they were able to bring it forth with one of the other ones, like the lymphoid leucosis. So, they need to look at that kind of situation and get it over with, be done with it. But I think we can move on a little bit. We're on an osteopetrosis thing. We might want to just mention some scaly leg mites real quick.
Okay, great.
I've been dealing with several different issues over the past several weeks. I don't pretend to be an expert on lice and mites and all that kind of thing. I don't think you need to be an expert. You need to recognize it and deal with it. I don't particularly care, as I do with most diseases, about incubation times and all that other stuff. Waste of time. It's kind of like remembering that, I guess it's not even correct these days, but that Columbus discovered America in 1492. Who cares when he did it, as long as you know he did it. It's irrelevant. Incubation times and all those kinds of things for me, if I want to know about them, I know where to get it. I know most of them because most of them are about the same time frame as far as most diseases are concerned. But my point is, you bog yourself down with a whole bunch of other stuff and you forget the real reason why you were asking the question in the first place. So the scaly leg mites, they're kind of like a chigger, and they are small and burrow under the skin of the legs. They, on the rare occasion, and I've never seen it in true life myself during my career, but they can get into the comb and the wattle area as well. And that may be because of the fact that there's high blood concentrations when we did that segment on the comb and so on and so forth, that it's the comb is highly vascularized, so they may make their way there. They tunnel under the skin of the leg. It's obvious to you when you see it. The leg becomes thickened. Not because of the osteopetrosis, but because of the fact that the scales and the tissue is being raised up as the mites burrow around and eat flesh and whatever they can under under the skin. They generally spread by contact from contaminated equipment, roosts. If you had some birds with it and you didn't notice it and you sent those birds to market and then you put some fresh birds in that coop without doing a complete disinfection and treating for all kinds of mites and what have you, they would probably at some point jump back on birds where that infestation is coming from, the roost material or crates that you might use, those kinds of things. So it's a contact thing. It needs to have contact of some sort to spread it, but it does spread. It's a slow spreader. Doesn't seem to be one that jumps all over the place like some of the others we'll talk about here in a minute. But it does really does a nasty number on the bird's legs. If anybody has ever really seen it, especially one that's out of control, I've seen them where the toes are all disjointed and. I've seen one case where the legs are just bloody from it. It was just a mess. Taking care of these things, recognizing what it is. I think the biggest thing you take away from this is the fact that when you see it, again, this is something that picking up birds and looking at them on a regular basis, you don't have to go out today and pick up all your birds, but if you picked up a few every day and especially a good time to see them is when they're gone to roost. You can pick them up and handle them, put them right back, and they'll squawk a little bit, but they're not going to fight you so much. And just go along the roost line and pick them up. Real easy. Just give them a real good check over. You can look for mites. You can look for lice. You can look for scaly leg mites or any other abnormalities. You can look for butts that are all stuck with manure and stuff. So you can tell a lot about your flock just by going in there and taking a look-see. At the same time, before you even pick up the first bird, listen to them. Listen to them breathe. You can pick up any respiratory issues that might be coming about. Gives you an opportunity then when you pick the birds up, you know, to quickly look in their eyes, check their mouth. When you look in the mouth, you might be checking for canker. That seems to be another thing we're seeing more and more of here recently. And this is probably because people don't recognize it, don't understand it. People are swapping birds more now than they probably ever did before. And so when birds that are, that have it are shipped off to people who don't have it, it becomes a problem. And it can become aggressive. Problem with canker is that it is a disease that we only have about two or so medications to use to deal with it, and they are fast building resistance. And a lot of this is because it is a every week thing in the pigeon industry. People who race pigeons and stuff like that, they use it all the time because they don't want it at all. And because it saps the bird's performance and so on, so they use it on a regular basis. Therein lies the problem, the continual use of something when there isn't anything necessarily there. So there's a whole lot you can do about, you know, taking care of the health of your bird. It's like maintaining your car. If you never check the tires and you never check the oil, you're eventually going to have a problem. The best way, in my opinion, to take care of this is there are those that would give ivermectin, which may work. In some areas of the country, it doesn't work, so that's kind of a hit and miss. I like the 10% permethrin mixed up in a tote and stand the bird in it for a minute or so right up to its thighs. Come back in 10 to 14 days, do it again. Take the material in the tote and filter out any feathers, manure, anything that's in it, put it in a pump-up garden sprayer, and spray all your roosts. So you get a double-action deal out of it, and you know it's relatively inexpensive to do, relatively easy to do, because you're only probably going to do the birds that actually have a problem versus doing an entire group of birds. But that's the best way. I know about all of the other idiotic ways. I'm not even going to mention them. I'm so sick of it. Just bear in mind that if this were you with chiggers, you wouldn't be dousing yourself in used motor oil, turpentine, or any other idiotic thing. So, and I don't mind saying it. It's just the way it is. Some of the other things that people might want to use, there are some people that like 7. If you like it, go ahead and use it. I'm not going to argue the point. It's, but it's something I would not use. Pyrethrins, they generally don't work because they don't really absorb into the skin like the permethrin product would, and I doubt that you're going to get any real good coverage with it. And there's no residual activity to it. The difference between the two, the permethrin and the pyrethrin, is the permethrin has some residual activity, so once it stops, once it dries, it still continues to work. But it will absorb into to the skin of the bird, and generally will take care of them first time around. You come back 10 to 14 days, do it again. As an insurance policy, you don't necessarily have to do that, but I highly recommend it. And it's your first opportunity. Clean the whole coop out, get rid of all the old bedding and everything else, clean it all down, wash it all down, and then get some fresh permethrin mixed up and go through and you know, do every nook and cranny everywhere. We're just in the middle of putting up roost material in our coop here. We're few weeks away from actually putting chickens in it, and I've chosen to use as a roosting perch material, and it's more expensive to do, but I only intend to do it once. I don't want to do this 14 times, and so what we're using to mount it on the wall is the plastic 2x4s. I don't know if you've ever seen them, but you can get them at any whatever. Yeah, they're expensive, but you know, you don't need a ton of them. And the roost material that I'm using is an extruded plastic that is really heavy duty. So for about a 4 foot or so piece, I only need two mounting brackets. And so I need to make, we're making 6 mounting brackets, and we're going to have 3 different tiers of roosting, one lower for real, real small birds, and the ones that really like to be up the top. So we got, top, middle, and I've got them staggered so the ones on the top aren't going to be defecating on the birds on the bottom and so on and so forth. So kind of looking at a couple of things, and that's underway. Everything's bolted together, bolted to the wall with lag bolts and whatever. It's not coming down anytime soon. no sharp edges or anything you have to worry about. You can take it all off, and you can take it outside, steam it, wash it, do what you want with it, put it back up. More of a pain in the neck for the brackets to do, but it's doable. As far as the roost perch material itself, take out 2 bolts on either side, take it off, take it outside, scrub it, put it back in. There's no peeling, there's no chipping, there's no splintering. And it's clean, good to go, and it should last forever. And like I said, we will eventually sell that in a probably about a 3 foot or so, whatever will fit in a container that can ship reasonably. But so that's what we're doing to do that. Doesn't mean you won't get them, but it's a whole lot easier to clean them up. And that's the whole idea and design of the building that we've constructed. And it's going along pretty good. Now I've got to get the outside yard within the inside perimeter of the run itself, get all of that straightened out. All of the grow-out frames are made in there, and they're all attached to the fence and the whole bit. So we're getting ready to crank it up. So
awesome deal. Yeah, 'tis the season.
Yeah. Did you want to take a break, Andy? It's one.
I'm just about to ask. Yep, I'll go ahead and take a short break, and we come back. Yeah. We'll continue.
Come back.
With
we'll go
Peter.
On with lice or whatever.
That sounds good. All righty, and we'll be back talking to Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, here today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. If you've missed a portion of the show so far, don't worry. After the show ends, it will be archived on iTunes.com, Zoom.com, Podcast.com, and right here on BlogTalkRadio.com. So stay with us. We'll be back right after this short break.
Established in 1957, GQF has become the name to trust when it comes to quality products and superior customer service. GQF offers a wide range of poultry products, including incubators, brooders, feeders, waters, and much, much more. Give them a call at 912-236-0651 or visit them online at GQFradio.com. That's GQFradio.com.
Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry, from rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams. Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer, here to tell you that if you have backyard poultry, nothing is more important than making sure your feathered friends are safe from infectious poultry diseases. Learn the simple steps to keep your birds healthy by visiting this website, healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov.
That's healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov.
A message from the USDA.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
Actually, in reality, I am Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today, Monday, on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, where we have Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of FirstSteakVetSupply.com. We would love for you to go over to his site and take a look at everything he has for the health of your chickens, including that awesome emergency medicine kit, not necessarily a first aid kit, but emergency medicine kit. Wound spray is not going to help you too much if you have some disease or illness in your first aid kit, but this emergency medicine kit can and will. So check that out, FirstStateVetSupply.com. Peter, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Andy. One thing I want to mention about the scaly leg mite is that, you know, unlike other things like lice and the northern fowl mite, you're not going to see them because they are burrowing under the skin. So they're real small. So I just want to, you know, because it's kind of like if you don't say all these things, then somebody will take it the other way. So, well, I didn't see them, therefore I didn't have them, even though they were there. The tip off is the raising of the scales, the very unsightly looking. You'll know it. Just compare it to a normal leg, and you'll see. And it generally is not everybody. I've only seen it in flocks where. Two or three birds maximum. I've never seen a whole lot more than that. If I've seen more than that, I don't remember it. Just something that you don't see a ton of, but, you know, it's just one of those things. I just want to put that out there, you know, for people. Yeah, go ahead.
Question in the chat room. This is going to apply to lice and mites, not necessarily the scaly leg mites, because you talk about doing a tote and dipping them in that solution. But here for mites and lice, can you dip birds for lice and mites, or is it better to spray them? I feel like spraying may not cover well enough. And then to follow up with that, are lice and mites common? And I tell folks that if you have backyard poultry, you at the very least, need to know how to identify where they're at, how to look for them, how to see them, see eggs, see down, you know, if you identify if you have them or not, and then have that know-how of how to treat if you do. I'm just going back thinking of our last location in the last decade. We've had one, and it was weird, we had one chicken with mites, and it was truly one. And I checked every single chicken we had, nothing but one. We did, but we still, again, we treated that one chicken, and then we cleaned out coop, things like that. And that was one case in over a decade where we identified them, and they were truly on one chicken. And I looked with a fine-tooth comb after hours, in case if it was a nocturnal mite that came out only after dark and then as the sun come up, hid during the day, or if it was all you know. So we are they common? Hey, in a decade, we had one issue in over a decade with mites. So I don't know if I'd use the word common. As many people have chickens now, it may seem like it's common if you hear people that have them because so many people are having them. But back to you, Doc. Can you dip them, or is it better to spray? She just feels like she may not get the coverage she would want if she sprayed.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I'll answer it in this way. Mm-hmm. If you were to mix up the permethrin product the way they tell you to, they tell you, and I just laugh at some of this because, you know, then they tell you to spray it on the bird. And that spray is good for X amount of birds. I think it's 100 birds or whatever it is. And you're supposed to use a half an ounce per bird. Well, if you're spraying, how do you know that? You know, how do you get that precise with, you know, does it matter at the end of the day? You know, whether you use an ounce or a half an ounce or a quarter of an ounce or three quarters of an ounce, how would you know? So it's a goofy way to even begin to do it. I personally I think your best coverage is to dip them. Pain in the butt, a lot of work, but most effective, in my opinion. If you need, you know, a quick stopgap measure, let's for instance say you're dealing.
No matter how much we pamper our chicken.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. That happens on regular TV too. But well, you think you got the market cornered on that? But I prefer the dipping method, and I'll tell you why. Because you're able to ruffle up the feathers the opposite way while they're in a solution, and get that solution right down to the skin. It goes through all the feathers, and it will kill off pretty much everything pretty quick. And if it doesn't, those that are still crawling around are going to be, you know, punch drunk from this stuff, and it won't be long before they die. When it dries, it continues to work as long as the bird doesn't get, you know, extremely dirty. If they go and take an immediate dust bath, certainly that's going to shorten the life of the residual, which is what it continues to work after they die. It dries, rather. But I much prefer that. But if you want to use a stopgap measure, let's say you go out and you go, oh, back end's loaded with northern fowl mites, and we'll go into that in a few minutes. But I've got, you know, 5 or 6 chickens like that. Get your permethrin out and get your sprayer out. When they go to roost, wet the back end of them down best you can.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, try not to, you know, stay right at the vent. But you got to spray all around it, you know, and that'll get some control. Right off the off the top. Now, if you decide that you, or if you are in an organic situation, or just preferring a more natural method, by all means, take the poultry protector spray, and I highly recommend it. Mix it at the strongest strength on the bottle, and dip the bird in it, and let it sit there for a couple, 3 minutes right in the water. I wouldn't do that with the permethrin. Permethrin in, get them all good and wet, and right back out. Because these two products work totally different. If you left the bird in the water with the permethrin in it for too long a period of time, it will basically interfere with the electrical impulses, the synapses from muscles to brain and so on, and you could end up with birds that are dead, or birds that have all kinds of little abnormalities because the permethrin will interfere with that. But as a quick dip in and out, as long as you get the bird nice and wet, and then just toss them right out on the ground there, or in a pen or wherever you're doing it, so that they can have an opportunity just to shake off all the excess, which they'll do. They'll be fine. It's done all the time. People in the game fowl industry bring it up only because they do it. That's how they do it. They don't bother to spray every bird. They go. They get a couple of guys together or whatever it is, and they go around and pick them all up and stuff them in the water real quick. Right back out, and you gain control quickly. But I realize everybody, you know, for the most part, works for a living, and can't necessarily run out every morning and do this stuff before you go to work. So, to gain control, you could use the poultry protector the same way. You could use the permethrin the same way. I recommend either one of the two because they really, really work if done properly. And so, you know, from that standpoint, you know, that's the direction I would go, and I recommend that to people all the time. And I even have, you know, for the scaly leg mite, I have those directions all worked out here on paper and how much you're supposed to use per gallon and so on and so forth. And when people ask for them when they buy the permethrin, I give it to them. But that's the way I would do it with the lice. I prefer the dip as well, because now you're talking about eggs. You're talking about encasement in a casting from the egg itself, or like a shell if you want, and you need some penetration of that to try to get it through. I don't think the spraying gives you enough coverage because not for nothing, but there's like 7 species of lice. Each one lives in a different area of the bird for the most part. You got head lice, you got wing lice, you got body lice. Like I said before, who really cares? Recognizing them on the bird whether they're attached to the feather shaft, the end of the feather, whether they're attached to the head feathers, really is immaterial as to what you want to call them. Once you recognize that they're lice, they look like a little piece of rice, so to speak, semi-transparent, depending on the stage of where they're at. Just get your stuff out and get after it. It doesn't really matter. Like, again, it goes back to, who cares about incubation time? Once you got the problem, we're past the incubation time, so it really doesn't matter. I mean, if you want to know it for historical purposes, that's fine. But as far as mitigating the current problem, whether it be lice, mites, scaly leg mite, or coryza, or CRD, or any of those coccidiosis, who cares about the incubation time? You got a problem at hand, let's deal with that. If you want to go back historically and look at it, that's a different story. And that's my take on it. Go ahead.
And you've been on a lot, so I'll ask this because, again, some of us and some people might be thinking, I know you normally carry a product, the Poultry Protector, and it comes in a spray bottle, but I believe it also comes with, in say, a gallon jug that you can then mix it or dilute it to make it into an individual spray bottle. So I guess there's different levels of dilution that you can use. But regarding the mites and lice, I know on many other topics you talk about, if you use the more natural product, all natural product like the Poultry Protector first, because you want to go that route and you don't get the results, especially if it's an infestation, you probably will have to go with the more powerful, say, chemical product. But I'm not sure, but I think you've talked before about how you could mix that Poultry Protector in different levels of concentration, and you could use that to also dip the birds for the mice and lice. And I know that product does kill the pupa and the eggs and the baby and the larvae and the adult birds all. So I'm guessing you could mix it yourself into a larger tote and dip in that to try if you wanted to go the all-natural route first. But I know you're an advocate of that. Look, if you, just like with diatomaceous earth and these other things, if you wait until you have an infestation or you do have an infestation, that's probably not going to be your best bet if you have an infestation. Maybe as a preventative measure if you see a few, but there's a time when you might have to use the real good stuff or, say, the chemical stuff. I don't want to say good because, with this mites and lice, you still, does that still kind of apply, that theory of thought?
Yeah, I advocate that, and in actuality, one of the things that I like about the Poultry Protector product line is that you could use it every day if you have to. I mean, look,
right.
For the most part, from my perspective, doing this a long time, I've looked into a lot of the natural things. Some work, some don't. I've looked into why they don't, as best this can be done with as much research as is out there now.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see things coming down the road that are going to be enhanced so that they do work better. We see that with the curcumin and the turmeric with the bioperine. We're seeing it now. This oil of oregano has been a fantastic product.
Using that instead of the antibiotics on.
We've had tremendous success. I don't know of an instance where it has been used where it didn't work. Now, I will say this, I don't have, not everybody calls me back or sends me an email and says, hey, stuff was great, but I do have a major breeder of poultry here, of a particular type of breed that's very popular, and this person has used it now on several occasions to take care of, loose droppings and everything else, and then with 2 or 3, 4 days, done, fixed. And I'm not trying to say it's a miracle thing, it's an alternative to the antibiotics that people don't want. And I am trying to encourage people to use these things on a regular basis, because that's where the key is, on a regular basis. And look, mites are no different. It doesn't matter whether it's lice, it doesn't matter whether it's mites. It's a maintenance thing. You go out, you pick them up, you see what you got going on. If you don't have lice and mites, do your little cock-a-doodle-doo dance in the middle of the yard because you're lucky and you don't have to deal with it. But as far as, waiting until you have a full-blown infestation of mites is, it's crazy. I mean, it's a thing where, by the time you find out what's going on, Everybody and their mother on the farm has got it. Now you got to go through and you got to do all these things and try to get it. And a lot of people have the idea, well, I did the birds and I still got the problem. Well, if you don't do that coop and those chickens at the same time, you might as well leave the stuff in the bottle, because it's going to be a perpetual problem. And, you know, the other thing that I caution people about too, and I didn't mention this, but Frontline, great product, but I'm waiting too for the day that it doesn't work, because more and more people are going to it. It's great. It gains great control if it's used properly and everything else, but the continual use of it, just like ivermectin doesn't work very well in a lot of places. Some places it does, some places it doesn't. The old malathion that we used to be able to get doesn't work anymore. Ampril and Corid and those two products, which are basically the same, they have places where they don't work either. And a lot of it is because of the way these things are used continually, day in, day out. I know people that I've advised against doing this, but have birds that they can continually keep them on a medicated starter forever. And, you know, they say, well, I don't have a problem with coccidiosis. I say, no, but one day you will. one day you will. Yeah, I will say this, and this will probably cause me some pain, but I have found, and I say this to a degree, tongue-in-cheek, probably come back to haunt me and hurt me more than it'll help me, but I have found that, in this particular business, people are inherently cheap. And I'm sorry to say that, but, some are, some aren't. For instance, I'll give you an example. I was on one of the boards yesterday, asked to comment on something, and somebody was on there and, had worked in the food industry and has supposedly a minor in chemistry, which I doubt. If it did, didn't learn anything. But, they're talking about using the oxine versus the chlorine product that you would use to shock your pool. So why would you even have that crap around your chickens? I mean, it's toxic as all get out. And if you read on, you'll find out that it's because for $4 I can make a ton of it. Mm-hmm. And the oxine, for wherever you want to buy it, from whatever it's priced out on the internet to whatever, this person thought that was extremely expensive. No, you're just cheap. That's all there is to it. You don't just come out and say it. You're a cheapskate. You don't want to do this. You think you know everything. And, my reply was, well, try taking your chlorine solution and doing a nasal flush with it. Try washing an eye out with it. You know, so they forget the versatility of it. They're not even interested in that, And then, said he didn't want to get in a big argument about it. And I just said, hey, it's not for me to argue about. Do as you please. Really don't care. This is the kind of mentality that you run into quite often, actually. And thank God there are enough people out there that I deal with that don't do this and are willing to do the right thing for their birds and do it continually and take good care of the birds. But this is one of the things that keeps me off the boards, because I don't have the time, nor do I want to spend the time trying to educate an idiot. Just not yet interested in it. And I've got better things to do with my time. A lot of folks that listen to this show and email me and what have you, I'm glad to help them, and you all know that. It's just one of those things. People are going to do what they want to do, and that's fine with me. I'm okay with it. I've learned quite a few lessons over the years, and one of them is I'm not interested in arguing. I'm not interested. I was asked to go to another site here over the weekend too and make some statements about coccidiosis, which I did, and I gave everything historically. And I even made the statement. I said, look, I'm not here to tell people you should use medicated feed. That's not the crux of what I'm trying to say here. And I just went on about my business and left it. I'm not going to go back and add any more to it. It is what it is. And if you don't want to pay attention, you don't want to believe in it, go on with it. I'm okay. I'll still be here. So, it's just one of those things. So the lice, no big deal. You look for the eggs. They are generally attached to the feather shaft. And you get your permethrin out. You either spray it or dip your birds in it. Getting some of the eggs off of the feathers afterward can be a problem. I'll leave that up to you, how to get them off. I've never found an easy way other than sitting there and picking them off. Their life cycle is about 3 weeks. So you might want to know that, just for the heck of it. They generally will live for several months on the bird, but they don't live well off the bird, which makes them more host dependent. Okay, meaning that they need to get their nourishment from the host, which would be the chicken. And there, you may see some of the chicken lice on your ducks and geese as a general rule, but they're generally not there trying to set up shop. They're usually, but not always, host-specific on that either. But just throw that out there. Turkeys kind of like have turkey lice and so on that don't really get around to bothering chickens. And you'll know them. They appear as small clusters of eggs. Takes up to about a week or so, depending on the weather and the humidity, and all this stuff plays into it as to how quickly they'll hatch. I think this is interesting to put out here. This is a piece of data that is important, but one pair of lice can produce upwards of 100,000 offspring in 60 days. So you can see not controlling these things can be extremely problematic to you and detrimental to the overall well-being of your flock. So it's just one of those things. And, you know, like I say, they don't live long after they get off the host for whatever reason. So if you can, you know, get after it, clean them up, and go on with it, shouldn't be a big problem. You got any questions on anything about
no.
that?
No.
Okay.
No.
Northern foul mite, probably the most common, the most prolific mite you'll see. Generally, you'll see this around the back end of the bird, right around the vent. That's at least where they start. They can migrate to any part on the bird. But they get their moisture from the vent opening itself, from the cloaca. And so you generally will see them there. If it's a bad enough infestation, you will see them appear as big, large clumps of black pepper is what they appear to be. And excuse me just a second here. I have company here today. much like you do, Andy.
I know exactly. I thought for a minute. I was like, yeah, I know who that is.
He's been real good putting up with me for the last hour or so. He's a hoot. But these are different than the lice. The lice actually don't suck blood. They will if it's the only thing available, but they eat the feathers and the bits of skin more so than the northern fowl mite will. They're blood suckers. And if you have them bad enough, you'll see them down on the vent area, and you may see some scabbing where they've chewed the skin off and been sucking blood and that kind of thing. All of these things, whether they be lice, whether they be scaly leg mites or northern fowl mites, all will end up causing egg production problems. Just the mere fact of constantly disturbing the bird and putting the bird in a fight or flight mode, so to speak, can stop egg production, if not slow it down. So there's a lot of detriment to it. The big thing about it, spreading disease, I don't think that's as big a deal today as it might have been years ago. And in maybe some cases, it might be somewhat unfounded. But it is possible these are extreme cases, and I've only seen a couple of them in my career, thank God. But birds become real emaciated with these. They can stop them from eating, just doing anything. It's kind of like, I guess, in a sense, being overwhelmed by a swarm of bees. And you eventually can't run, you can't move. All you do is stand there, and they just keep stinging. It's kind of like the same thing, although they're not stinging. Just being overwhelmed by them everywhere and not having a second's peace. So it's important, you know, that these things be controlled. These are easy to find, harder to find on your darker birds, obviously, but if you look down on the skin, They'll readily crawl on humans. My first encounter with northern fowl mites was in a poultry production class in college, and we had a bunch of cages up at the front of the room, and you had to go through, and we weren't looking for mites, although they found me real quick. But the idea was to take each bird out and examine it and tell what stage of production it was in by looking at the overall bird, the comb, the wattles, the degrees of bleaching of the shanks and the feet and the comb and the wattles and the beak and all of those things, and the shape and moisture of the vent and what have you. So I reached in and picked up this big old barred rock, and I had them all up against me. I was just tickled to death. I was handling chickens. This was cool and everything else, and I went back to my seat, and by jeebus, they were all up and down my arm. And it was an evening class. It was one of those 7 to 10 classes, and by God, it was the first thing out of the box is what we did. And all night long, even though there were only a handful of them really on me, geez, I wasn't the only one. There were a whole bunch of us that were just squirming in our seats all night long. So it has taught me a lesson that you don't hold them up against you, you hold them out from you, and you examine them and see what's going on. And you check the vent and everything else before, even though that may not be where you're really wanting to look, you check it just to make sure that they aren't around there. My feeling is that they are drinking moisture from the vent, and I also think, and this is not based on any science or any testing that I've done, just on observation, many times we will see them on males versus females, and the only thing that comes to mind would be hormones. Male hormones versus the female hormones, and that's just pure speculation on my part, just me thinking off the top of my head as to why that may be. And I've never found anybody that was able to give me a bona fide answer as to why that is. It may be just coincidence, and then again, it may not. Again, this is spread by contaminated equipment. Again, contaminated housing. You don't clean it out, and you put fresh birds in, and you just keep perpetuating the problem. Birds that are out on free range can easily pick these up from free-flying birds. They carry it readily. So it is a problem. I would do the same thing with these that I would with the lice. Earlier somebody asked about spraying versus dipping. Even though the dipping is a lot more laborious and a lot more effort, I would certainly dip the birds and get this under control and spray the whole coop down, clean everything out, and get it under control. You may have to do it several times before you gain control. That's the issue. You want to do every little nook and cranny. I don't care if the literature says that the birds don't, these mites and stuff don't live well off of the birds. I don't care. We want to douse everything, leave no stone unturned, because if your luck runs like mine, the first stone you don't turn over is the one where the snake is, and it bites you. So, that's generally the way my luck has run. So you're better off to turn over all the stones, give everything a good washing down, and use the 10% permethrin as the product you want to use. Very easy to use. Safer than... let me just throw this out there. Technically speaking, no insecticide that is chemically based is, so to speak, safe. What we look at is some that are safer than others, or better to use, less troublesome, less problems, and that kind of thing. If I were going to dip birds, I would have a rubber apron on, boots, and the longest pair of rubber gloves that I could find, something that went up partway up my arm. Comes to mind. You might even seek out somebody who can get some of those long-sleeved type gloves they use for artificial insemination in cattle. They'd work pretty good.
Right. Yeah.
Easily disposed of, that kind of thing. Just as a precautionary thing, because this stuff will absorb into the skin, just like ivermectin. Pore on it is made to absorb into skin. There have been people who have gone to the hospital over the years with ivermectin toxicity due to the improper use of the ivermectin on chickens and so on, and getting it on themselves and everything else. It's never a big deal till something happens. We all know that.
And, right, right.
You know, things left to chance certainly would. But on this northern fowl mite, one more thing here before we kick this to the curb.
Okay.
Basically, these are capable of living on and off the bird. They'll get off the bird and come back on, get off the bird and come back on. And one more reason why we do every little nook and cranny with these things. They're very prolific, only takes a few days for them to hatch out, whereas the lice took several days up to a week. Again, conditions here, the right temperature, the right humidity. We see less of them in the summer, and we see more of them in the fall and winter months. Not exactly sure why that particular type of thing takes place. But in all of these things, you can see dramatic body loss, weight loss, emaciation, feather loss, scabbing of the skin, all of these kinds of things. Very uncomfortable for birds. I think it would behoove anybody to get this under control. Going back to the poultry protector thing one more time, I really believe in that product. I sell it in the spray bottle. I sell it in the 33-ounce concentrate, and I do sell it in the gallon. I'm one of the few people around on a net that does sell it on the gallon. But it is a good product and works very well. Now, you're not going to get the quick knockdown with it, irregardless. I don't care what anyone says. You're not going to get the quick knockdown with it, in my opinion. You may have to come back and do it several more times, but it is not toxic at all. You know, this one.
We've had him on the show. He used an example one time about maybe it was a flea, and the lady flea jumped on the table. She sprayed it with that on the table, and he's like, it, you know, she's like, and it walked away, it crawled away. And so he's like, well, where did it go? And you know, that type of thing. He said, yeah, you're not going to get the like raid where you spray a spider and it immediately dies. It's a natural
paralyzed
process.
Right where it is in its tracks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And, you know, you have to
that's
look
all I tell you.
Yeah, you have to look at the toxicity of it. You know, like I said, we're moving and have moved. Now we have a number of products now that are considered organic. All of the poultry protector items, you know, the turmeric, the diatomaceous earth, the oil of oregano. Just recently put up some water soluble vitamin E. I think it's up there. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. I think it is. And also sea kelp. I've got a real good quality sea kelp from a friend of mine who's been, actually he's been selling it for years, and I buy it directly through him, and it's a bargain. It, I think it's $21.95 for 5 pounds. It's not bad, and something you feed free choice and stuff. So we're moving that direction more and more, and you know, it's just one of those things that people are wanting, and you know, and I see the good side of it. You know, this is a little bit off subject, but you know, Big Flat a while back about the Roxarsone and the arsenic in, food. You know, and I listened to a debate the other day here locally, because it's banned here now in the state of Maryland. It was an interesting thing. You know, the person who was representing the poultry industry was trying to, you know, defend themselves for the possible use of it in poultry, not in Maryland because it's banned here, but it has never been banned elsewhere, to my knowledge, and the manufacturer voluntarily pulled it from the marketplace, so right now you couldn't use it if you wanted to unless there was some laying around somewhere. But, you know, and he was trying to talk about, and rightfully so, there were two sides to the coin, but I think her argument, she was a lady that was representing some organization that was more interested in, you know, what's in the food and this and that and the other thing. And, you know, he was saying, well, you know, it's I don't remember, 1,000 parts per billion, which is quite small. And he was comparing it to the circumference of the Earth that would be equal to 1.7 inches, you know. And all, in my opinion, irrelevant stuff to take your mind off the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And her comeback was, you're right. It isn't much. But it's something we don't need in our food. And it's something that we can control because he went into, you know, there's apple juice, it's got more than the FDA says should be in it, and right tested, and, you know, it's naturally occurring. And we know all of this. We know all of this. But, you know, I worked for that company for close to 10 years. And I'll tell you this, and you can look it up. And the company originally, Salisbury Laboratories, used to be out of Charles City, Iowa. So here's the downside of it. From making this stuff there in Charles City, Iowa, you can look it up and see on the Superfund site, it is one of the most toxic sites in the country. Okay? So there are more things to it than just having it in your food. You know, at the end of the day, I don't think it's a big deal in the food per se. I've eaten more chicken that's had arsenic in it than you can shake a stick at. Okay? But that's not the point. Her point was extremely valid from you know, and I know this is off topic, but I think it's important, you know, to look at it objectively. And I said to myself, you know what? She's making a good argument. Don't need it. You know, if we can do without it, why put it in? If it happens naturally, so be it. But if you're going to end up putting it in there to gain an advantage dollar and cents wise, I don't buy it, say. And it makes so much more sense to me having somebody presented in that light. And I didn't care after that what stone he threw. It didn't make any difference to me. You know, and he didn't really have much after that. You know, it was just like, you know, well, it's in apple juice, it's in this, it's in that. Well, they're naturally occurring. They're not adding it to it, you see. So, I mean, you know, it was just an interesting argument. And we've talked about it on the show before. And, I think back then I had a little bit different position. But, you know, positions change as you become more knowledgeable and you find out more information and everything else. But that was I thought it was a very powerful point.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like you do. I mean, I think that also you do what you can. You know, I mean, I'll see folks that'll type online or something about, oh, you should buy American, and they're wearing a Casio watch, and their Nikes are made in wherever, and they're typing it on a computer made in China, and, you know, you do what you can. So they buy American cars, and they try to buy American when they're in the stores, but you can't do it 100%. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I eat vegan and I'm vegetarian, but I have leather seats in my Prius. You know, it's just like, again, you try to do what you can, and I get it. And we all do that. We all, and you try not to be a hypocrite about it, and you just try to, hey, this is the way, you know, I feel may be best. This is what we do, take it or leave it. And, yeah, I think that, you know, try to do what you can with what you got. You know, it's not going to be 100%. I don't care who you are or what you do. I think that's a good analogy is that, you know, hey, you know, but
well, I have this to say about what you just said there about buying American. Okay, I'm all for it, you know, but I will say this to most people: if you really do the research, most companies have moved out of here not because of the wages they had to pay here, but because of the Environmental Protection Agency rules, regulations, and so on and so forth. They're so stringent that it makes it so difficult to operate. High wages doesn't help either. But, you see, herein lies the problem from my perspective. When you have the standard of living that we have in this country, it requires a lot more money in order to maintain that standard of living. Okay? Therefore, the items that you're making in this country have to go up in price. People will not pay it.
Right.
People will not pay it. I'll give you an example. Up in Faribault, Minnesota, a company used to make wool blankets up there, and they went out of business. Okay. A entrepreneur or two in town bought the old mill, put the same people back to work, and they're back making blankets. Well, if you look at some of the prices of the blankets, I mean, they're expensive. Are you willing to pay in excess of $100 for a wool blanket made in America? That's the question.
When I went to Tractor Supply before Christmas this past year, and we were talking about different concerns, things we see posted on Facebook and all of that, and in general conversation, I forget which department I was even with talking to, I had so many meetings that day, that came up, I wish you would buy more products made in America, and they agree. Tractor Supply and I don't want to put words in their mouth, but from our meeting that we had, we would love to have everything in our store made in America. They research everything. If it's going to be on a shelf, then I mean, I'm just still amazed and flabbergasted at the process anything has to go through to even be on a shelf. Because again, they only have so many square feet. If something goes on a shelf, something else in the store has to come out of the store in order to put something else in the store in most cases. But the thing was is that they could have two identical items. We'll just say a trivet and one trivet, same thing, same purpose, same everything, made in America. Right next to it, another trivet, again made, say, in China. One's $2.95, one's $6.95. They cannot sell the ones made in America for $6.95. They will sit on the shelf forever. And how long have they been in business? How long have they tried this? They know it's an issue. So they'll just sit that they will not sell for, oh, made in America. Even if you put a little tag on it, made in the USA, $6.95. Oh, but this one's $2.95. I'm grabbing this one. In fact, I'll grab two for the price of that one. So, yeah, I mean, I get it. Everybody gets it. Everybody wants to, but it's but the consumers, many probably who are saying, oh, you ought to buy American, are buying the one for $2.95 made in China. So,
exactly.
Darn it, again, do what you can with what you got, you know, uh-huh. Try to, you know, we understand, but nobody can be 100% all the time perfect, just like the, you know, you ought to buy American, and they're typing that on Facebook from their iPhone that's made in who knows where. So it's you just try to do your best.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I don't try to fight the fight. You know, I try to buy, you know, whatever I can that's American, and you can't always, you know. I was a GM guy many, many years until they kept, you know, sticking it to me with cars that weren't worth 2 cents, and I wouldn't give up my Honda for nothing. Sorry. That's the way it is. You know? And,
One of those.
You know, they brought it on themselves by not paying attention, you know. I mean, Ford didn't learn anything from this Chrysler and General Motors going bankrupt. They've got some problems with this EcoBoost car of this. You know what? Be a lot smarter. Say, hey, folks, bring them back to your dealer. Here's your little number, and pick out a car off the lot. Done. Take them all, send them to the crusher, okay, and be done with it, and you'd have a bunch of happy campers. No, now they got them in court suing them. That's real good publicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes everybody feel good about the product you're putting out there and trying to tell everybody. You know, it's all spin. Now you got to try to convince everybody it's a good car. I don't think so. Not a good idea.
It makes me wonder, you know, like I said, I'll see a lot. You know, there's a lot of foreign cars out there. We drive one, and we also have two American cars. I've got a Ford, I've got a Jeep, and then I've got the Kia. But my tractor's a Ford. But it's I'll see these stickers, you know, these veterans that truly fought for America, World War II, whatever, Vietnam, even, you know, Iraq War, whatever, and they'll have their sticker, whatever it is, you know, Marines, Army, Air Force, serve this, that, or the other, and it's plastered on the back of a Hyundai or a Toyota or a Nissan. And I'm just thinking, you know, hey, you know, that's interesting. Just interesting to me that, you know, stereotypical one would think that someone who fought, you know, against Korea wouldn't be driving a Kia. Someone who fought against Japan, back, you know, wouldn't be driving a Toyota. So it's just one of those things that interests me. Maybe it's not such a big deal as,
yeah,
you know, as some people perceive it to be, and that's something that I identify with. I'm like, hey, you know, this guy is a retired military, and he's driving a Toyota. So, I mean, it's one of those. I look at that, and I'm thinking, well, okay, maybe I don't feel so bad about driving this Kia, even though I've got the Ford and the Jeep and the Ford tractor and da-da-da-da, you know, so... It's
I don't feel bad about driving my Honda either. I'm a veteran too.
Yeah. So it's just one of those things. Hey, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Great topic, and we've been trying to get to it now for a couple of weeks, and covered a lot of great information for folks, answered some questions in the chat room, and so we do appreciate you coming on as always on Mondays. You can, if you like what you hear, tune in Mondays with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, and do visit his website and his store, www.firststatevetsupply.com. That's firststatevetsupply.com. I did put it in the chat room. Someone was asking, hey, he carries this. What's his website? We posted it in the chat room. So hopefully folks will be coming to visit you. And like we say, our opinion, if he doesn't have it, you don't need it, my friends. So, Peter, thank you very much for joining us, and we hope you have a great week, and we look forward to seeing you maybe next Monday.
Yep, well, it's maybe next week. Try to squeeze the thing in about the heat that we were trying to do a couple of shows ago, and we got tied up doing other things, whatever. So unless you got something else you want to do, you just shoot me an email.
That'd be
fine. Let me know. Yeah, we'll
Sounds
do that.
Sounds great. Also, tis the season. Great. Thank you so much, man.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, that's going to wrap up another show, Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We appreciate you tuning in today. We hope you'll tune in tomorrow. Who do we have on tomorrow? The American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. Yep, that is tomorrow, ALBC.org. Actually, it's ALBC-USA.org. Go visit them and see what great works they're doing. And we'll have Jeanette Behringer or one of the other staff there from ALBC, the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, on tomorrow. And it looks to me like, that'll be good. So that'll be tomorrow, 12 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on Blog Talk Radio. And again, we thank you very much for tuning in today. God bless.